Well, before I read chapter 6 of Esther, you've noticed, haven't you, the story continues to unfold as we've gone through week after week, just 5 weeks so far in this little book of Esther. And we're at that point in the story last week where there's not only a threat, remember, over all the Jews and the Persian kingdom, there's a threat hanging over Mordecai as well. So the story of Esther at this point seems to fulfill that old saying, smile, things could be worse, which is often followed by, I did smile, and things did get worse. And that's sort of where we are in the story of Esther. It's not looking good if you're Jewish and living in the Persian kingdom. It's the midpoint of the story, we might say, and not only in terms of the content, number of chapters, but in terms of the flow. This is the turning point, this chapter today. We'll be amazed to see what God will do. And at the midpoint, the Jews, remember, still under a death sentence. Mordecai is under a death sentence. Esther has been unable so far to make a difference in the lives of the Jews. She has been unable so far to even ask the king, her husband, to do what she desires for him to do. And the clock's counting down. It's counting down on the Jews. It's counting down specifically on Mordecai. There's a 75-foot gallows being built. May not have been a gallows like we think, the gallows of the Old West. Probably more a simple spike, 75 feet high, on which Mordecai would be impaled to his death. At least if Haman has his way. But even though we haven't seen in this book of Esther, and won't see, God's name mentioned the entire way through, and even though the characters of the story seem to do their best to ignore God in some ways, he refuses to be written out of the script. He's at work. He's behind the scenes. He's incognito. He's out of focus, but he's at work, and he's accomplishing his will. And Esther 6 begins to show us how he's going to do that. In fact, some people would say that Esther chapter 6 is a kind of case study in how God works all things together for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. So we want to see what that case study looks like. Let me read Esther 6. On that night, the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, what honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? The king's young men who attended him said, nothing's been done for him. And the king said, who is in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, Haman is there, standing in the court. And the king said, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? And Haman said to himself, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? And Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate. But Haman hurried to his house, mourning, and with his head covered. And Haman told his wife, Zeresh, and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife, Zeresh, said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him." While they were yet talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. May God bless the reading of his inerrant word. The turning point of the book of Esther happens when the king is unable to sleep at night. Now, it's somewhat comforting, isn't it, to think that a king can't sleep at night? I mean, if anybody ought to sleep, it ought to be a king. Sovereign king rules over all. You think they could go to sleep. The rest of us, we struggle at times. We have some insomnia at times. It's difficult. Something gets on our mind. It keeps us awake. Some worry, some pressure. The king feels that. Sometimes kings do feel that. Remember in the book of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar couldn't sleep because God gave him a dream that was so troubling, it kept him awake. And then Darius, another king, he couldn't sleep because all he could think about was Daniel being thrown into the lion's den. Daniel, whom he loved. How is it with Daniel? He was worried. He couldn't sleep. Ahasuerus, the Persian king, he can't sleep. Doesn't say why. Just says he can't sleep. What do you do if you're a king and you can't sleep? You can't watch TV yet. You can't catch up on some missed episodes of your favorite show. He doesn't pick up his greatest, latest novel and start reading a few pages of that. What does he do? I mean, he could have anything he wanted. He's the king. He could have some food brought in. He could have some other drink brought in. He could have some dancing girls brought in. He could have anything. What does he have? Instead, he has someone read to him from government documents. I get that. Now, these documents had to do with his reign. Notice verse 1. It says, he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the chronicles that were read before the king. It's still a government document pulled out of the archives. It'd be like us reading, you know, the IRS tax code. Sorry, Paul Munden, you're not here today. I can say that. That would keep Paul awake. The rest of us, we're out. The king has this brought in, and they begin to read. He doesn't fall asleep because something's read that catches his attention. In fact, he wakes up more. It's something about something that happened in the recent history involving this guy named Mordecai. It says so in verse 2. It was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And we remember the story from way back in an earlier chapter of Esther. Mordecai let it be known that it happened. Those two men were found out. The king was not hurt. They were. Mordecai saved the day. So, verse 3, the king said, "What honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" King's wondering, whatever happened to that guy Mordecai anyway? I see him in the gate every now and then. Did we ever honor him? Well, the answer is, well, nothing's been done. Well, now the king's really awake. Nothing's been done for this man who basically saved my life. We need to know that in Persian history, the kings were famous for the way they rewarded people who did things for them, who gave assistance to the kingdom, but particularly in a personal way. If you were to help the king, a Persian king would go way out of his way to honor you, to make you important, because you were important to him. So this reply, "Nothing has been done," wakes the king up completely. King Ahasuerus is now upset. He can't go back to sleep. Still the middle of the night, early morning perhaps. He's wide awake. He's ready to act. But what do? How does a king honor anybody? How does a king do anything? Most kings were known for the fact that they weren't necessarily real creative on how to do things within the kingdom. Oh, they're good at advancing the kingdom, of doing things like war and battles. But when it came to managing things, that's why they have advisors. They needed someone to tell them what to do. You know, it probably hasn't changed a whole lot, no matter what form of government. Most governmental leaders need advisors to tell them how to act in certain situations. That's what's happening here. That's why the king asks this interesting question, who's in the court? Now, what kind of question is that? Probably 2, 3, 4 a.m. What's the king asking? Who's in the court out there? There ain't nobody in the court. They're all asleep. No, they weren't. The king required there was always an advisor nearby. Happens, funny, isn't it, that the only advisor in the court at this hour of night is Haman, who just happens to have shown up with something else on his mind, because Haman couldn't sleep either. He was so excited, Haman was. He was about to get his wish taken care of, Mordecai impaled on a 75-foot stake for all to see. All he needed was the king's okay. So Haman had rushed into the Persian palace of the king so he could get that approval as fast as he could, but he can't wake up the king. He's got to wait for him to wake up, probably have his breakfast, at least a cup of coffee. Haman's in the court. The king's helpers, the young men, answer the question, verse 4, when he says, who's in the court? Haman had just entered. The king's young men, verse 5, said, Haman is there, standing in the court. The king said, let him come in. I need him, he's saying. I need advice. I need assistance. And so he comes in. This is where, as remember when I opened this series, I said that Esther was a book of humor. This is where we ought to be chuckling by about now. Haman comes in. And the king says to him, verse 6, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? Now, when the king says that, he just says, the man. He doesn't say which man, doesn't give a name. Haman has no idea whom the king has in mind, but Haman thinks he has an idea because he says to himself, who else but me? I mean, I'm the closest one to the king. I'm going again today to a feast given by Queen Esther for the king and me. I mean, whom else would the king honor if it's not Haman? So Haman basically asks for what would honor him. Notice what Haman doesn't ask for. Haman doesn't ask for wealth. He doesn't ask for power. Haman already has those things. Apparently quite wealthy as a king's advisor, quite powerful because he's close to the king, able to get his will done even by the king. So as Haman comes in and is asked what should be done, Haman says to himself, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? Chuckle, chuckle. Verse 7, Haman says to the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, honor him this way. Let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, a horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head is a royal crown. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to the one of the king's most noble officials. And let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor. Let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. This is Haman's idea of a perfect day. As long as Haman's the one on the horse. This is it. For Haman, he has just won the lottery. He has found the lamp with the genie, and he's rubbing that lamp to get his wish. This is perfect. Just imagine, you can get anything you want. Anything, one time. What is it going to be? For Haman, this is it. Remember, Haman, we saw last week, we might say he has some ego issues. He's pretty big in his own eyes, but he wants to be big in everybody's eyes. And this is how it could be done. Riding with the king's robes on the king's horse. Notice the king's horse even has a crown. Really? That's for Haman it. He's so excited. It can't get any better than this. However, the parade that Haman has in mind through the main plaza of the citadel of Susa, with all the important people watching the most important person being honored that day by the king, his very greatest idea of a perfect day turns instead to Haman's terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. Because that's what's about to happen, isn't it? Because the king lets him know what he has in mind. Verse 10, the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. What is Mordecai the Jew doing sitting at the king's gate? Well, probably, as we've noticed, he's a civil official of some kind who does some work for the king at the king's gate. It's not very high and mighty work. It's not flashy. He just does his job. He's a civil servant. Leave nothing out that you have mentioned, the king says. Not only that, Haman, you're the one who will lead the horse. Haman can't believe it, I'm sure. I mean, everything is just fallen apart. The world has come to an end. The bottom has dropped out. Whatever we can think of, a metaphorical way to say it, this is horrendous, terrible, rotten. It really is a very, very bad day. And so that's what happens. It happens that very time. As soon as the sun is up, I'm assuming as soon as Mordecai started his job at the king's gate, Haman went out with the king's robes and the king's horse and honored Mordecai for all to see. Even walking in front of him, announcing, this is how it's done. If the king delights in someone, this is the way he is honored. Which is a way of saying, you better bow to Mordecai, because the king has singled him out for special honor and special praise. By the end of the chapter, well, Mordecai does what Mordecai does. Notice it doesn't say much. Verse 12, Mordecai returned to the king's gate. That's all it says. He returned to the king's gate. What does that mean? He went back to work. He's been honored as the greatest, second greatest in the kingdom for his quick 15 minutes of fame. What do you do after that? You go back to work. I got work to do. He's a civil servant. He's got some pencils to sharpen at least. He's got some important things to do for the kingdom. He knows his role. He knows his position. Mordecai just does what Mordecai does. He goes back to work and does what's required of him. Haman, on the other hand, not so much. Says, but Haman hurried to his house. He wants to get out of sight as fast as he can. He has been completely humiliated in every way that he can think of. He feels terrible about himself. He needs to go somewhere where he'll be accepted, somewhere where someone will understand how bad things have turned for him that day. So he goes home. He hurries to his house. He's mourning. His head is covered in sign of mourning, as if he has died. Someone has. He feels like he has. Verse 13, Haman told his wife, Zeresh, and all his friends, everything that had happened to him. Just imagine the blow by blow. I went into the court of the king waiting for him to arrive so I could get permission to hang Mordecai on the stake 75 foot that I had erected. And instead, I'm leading Mordecai through the city so he can be honored and praised by all. How in the world could that possibly have happened to me? Now, you might think that his wife, Zeresh, and his young advisors, his friends, his wise guys, we could call them, that's what they're sort of called, might say something like this. Well, gosh, Haman, what did you do to offend the gods so much? I mean, what in the world have you done? Notice they don't really do that. You might think they said, oh, Haman, that's the worst that could ever happen. I know you must feel terrible. I mean, if they were Stephen ministers, they'd barely be giving care, you know? They would really ask some deep probing questions, reflective listening, and help them see what God was up to. But they do that second part. I mean, really, they go theological on him here. He wants solace. They go theological. Haman told his wife, told his friends. They say this, some pretty interesting words. If Mordecai, before whom you have now begun to fall, if he's of the Jewish people, you're not going to overcome him. In fact, you'll fall before him. Now, why would they say that? How do they know? I mean, there's a theological truth there about what God is up to. These pagans seem to see something that none of the God's people in Esther have seen yet. God's up to something. Haman, if Mordecai, the Jew, is winning out over you, you don't have a chance. Because we've heard of Mordecai's God. Doesn't say that in the text, but that's what's inferred here. How did they know? Maybe they took world history in 10th grade at Susa High School. And in that telling of world history, no doubt, in the history of the Near East, the ancient Near East, Middle East. They would have heard about the exploits of the God of Israel and the great kings like David and Solomon and the way that God brought his people out of Egypt. They would have known that story if they had any history in their educational background. They knew you don't mess with the God of Israel. Haman, if you're messing with Mordecai, and Mordecai is a Jew, and God of the Jews always wins. They've gone theological on Mordecai. There's no comfort here. You're doomed, buddy. You're doomed. I'm thinking Zeresh is saying, have you updated your will lately? Am I your only beneficiary? Just making sure. But in the midst of that talking, there's no time for Haman to reflect. If he had time, maybe someone could have pointed him to Psalm 2, verse 12. It says this, kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are those who take refuge in him. Maybe he could have had a Psalm 2 moment where he comes to grips with the idea that Haman himself needs to bow the knee to a greater thing than himself. That there is a God, and he's known here, the Son, pointing ahead even to Christ. Kiss the Son, which means embrace him. He is your refuge and strength. He is your only hope. And if you don't do that, remember, his wrath can be kindled and you will surely perish. But there's no time for reflection for Haman because verse 14 says, while they were yet talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. Haman's got to go to a feast. Haman at this point has pretty much lost his appetite. What a story. This is the turning point of this book. And the Jewish rabbis who write of it do write of the chuckle and the laughter that should be in this chapter as we see some amazing things that are going on. But what is going on? What's God doing here? What can we learn from chapter 6 of Esther? Well, you can't miss the evidence of God working. It's in this chapter as it is in the book, but it's so clear here. This isn't just a mere coincidence, just things happening to fall in place. This isn't just events evolving as the way they sometimes do randomly or some strange fate happening. You can see the work of God, the hand of God at work. You don't see the hand of God literally, do you? You see the evidence of it. There's a trail left in its wake that's unmistakable. Like the Spirit, we don't see the Spirit. We don't see the wind. But if you see the tree and its leaves moving, you know the wind is there. We see movement here in the redemptive story of this book, and we know God is at work. His providence is clear. So clear that even the pagans, Haman's wife and friends, they see it. They know it. The God of Israel has shown up. And once he gets involved, there is no doubt as to the outcome. And the involvement of the God of the universe is what we see here. The text doesn't give us a direct indication, but the pagans seem to know what's going on. So how about us? Do we see it when God's at work? We don't see his hand either. They didn't see his hand directly at work. But do we see it? Are we able to read the events, not only of the world, but our very lives and see God at work? Doing what he promises he's going to do in and through people like us? Do we have an unshakable confidence in his providential care for our lives and the lives of those we loved? Or do we have times when we're not so sure? We're not too sure, first of all, that he does care, or second of all, that he's got enough power to act on the care he has for us. What are we seeing? What are we sensing? But don't miss this little point. It's the most amazing point. It's the one that commentators love to talk about. Directly, here's a commentator, Karen Jobes, who writes this, quote, a seemingly insignificant event forms the turning point for the whole narrative of this book. That event, verse 1, on that night, the king could not sleep. That's the turning point. The king could not sleep. The turning point isn't Esther's decision to take a stand at the risk of her own life, to possibly risk as she barges into the king's presence uninvited. That's not the turning point of the story. Things get worse when she does that, not better right away at least. In fact, so far up to this point in chapter 5, there's no resolution on the death threats hanging over the Jews. There's now a death threat hanging over Mordecai. It's not Mordecai's bold, courageous decision not to bow the knee to Haman that saves the day for the Jews and turns the story around. It's a simple thing the king couldn't fall asleep. It's God at work. Notice chapter 6, Esther isn't even mentioned here. Mordecai is just kind of in a participatory role. He's not front and center. Really, who's not mentioned either, but is very front and center, is God. As one commentator put it, God's sovereign purpose works through his servants, but it does not depend on their willing obedience. Rather, their obedience itself is part of God's wonderful work. Just think of that. We might think that, oh, well, I make things happen. I save the day, and we are significant. I'm not saying that divine intervention makes all human action meaningless. Not at all. But human action comes because God is involved, even bringing us to points of obedience, so we might do God's work. If it was true for Esther and Mordecai and Haman and all those in this plot, it's true for us as well. We need to learn to rest in that, don't we? That in every situation, no matter what it is, God is at work in every location, in every experience, in every relationship. God is the one who is leading through his wise and careful administration of redemptive work through the Holy Spirit. He's the one doing it. He's the one. Paul Tripp, counselor and writer, writes a devotional every week called the Wednesday Devotional. He said something this week that so fit this part of Esther that I just want to read it to you as I close. It has some significance for us, I think. This is what Paul Tripp wrote, speaking of God working in our lives. He says, he has known from the beginning exactly what he was going to do and exactly why he did it in your life. From his, God's vantage point, there are no slip-ups, no oversights, no accidents, no misunderstandings, and no mistakes. Nothing has fallen through the cracks. Why is this important? Well, let's be honest. Our lives haven't unfolded as we had planned. Or, if you're young, you may know exactly what you want to accomplish, and there are things that you're determined to avoid, but it won't work out according to your script. That's the way it is. Then Paul Tripp says this, that's a good thing, although it might not appear to be so on the surface. Here's the simple truth. You and I don't write our own stories. They've been written for us. Our job is to live inside of the plot that God has determined in the way we've been called to live. But just like with our bodies and our gifts, there are times when we secretly wish we could grab a hold of the joystick and direct the trajectory of our lives. Guess what? God in love won't let go. As a result, we experience crushing disappointments, not because God is cruel, but because we let ourselves down with delusions of personal sovereignty. Wow. This man just spoke to me. He may have spoken to you too. So as I do close, let me remind you and encourage you with these words and this reminder from Esther 6, God is sovereignly working behind the scenes, often in ways that you don't see and don't understand. He is sovereign. You and I are not. He is the one who decides the fate of our world and our lives. We don't. This isn't just theology that we have to speak about on Sunday only. It's day by day, week after week. This is how we live. It's got to be the foundation of our identity. God is able, and he's for us, and he's for you. He's in absolute control. He's infinitely good. He's completely trustworthy all the time. With that in mind, keep your eyes open for the surprise turning points in your life. Let's stand as we pray. God, my guess is that there's probably not too many people in this room who wouldn't love to have a turning point in some part of their life. Just about all of us, Lord, have issues that we struggle with. Some of these we bring to you in prayer, some we hold on to selfishly with some sense of shame that we should fear or doubt, or just with the acknowledgement that we're so out of control that, gosh, we need help. Don't know what that'll look like, but you do. Because if Paul Tripp is right, and what he writes, I think, is based on your scripture, you're a God who is in control. Because of that, we need not fear. And although we'll feel disappointment because not all of our dreams and hopes will turn out the way we wish, we thank you, God, that you're making life turn out the way we need. Because you really are doing those things that Paul says you do in Romans 8. And among those is that you work through everything. In fact, you work for the good of those who are called according to your purpose. And you're doing that in our lives day after day in ways we can't see. So give us eyes to see the evidence of that, to follow the trail in the wake that it leaves as you're working in us. And give us lives that look like we really do trust you. So much so that the world around us might begin to wonder, who are these people? What directs their lives? Is there something greater than themselves? Because Jesus, you are that. And so we bring our prayer to you and our worship in your name. Amen.